Well, friends, I'm looking forward to this next message, The Attack of the Enemy. We have four more messages after this on Nehemiah. I hope that God's speaking to you, but I'm looking forward to this message. I don't know what it takes to stop you from doing something, but I remember a moment when I was about 12 years old that I had to stop somebody. If there was ever a person who could be the devil, it was the kid who lived a floor above me in our apartment building. There were these two kids that lived right above us, and this one kid was, I'm not just talking bad, I'm talking that he could have been the devil's child. I mean, he was so bad. I know that's mean, but you have to know this kid. My grandma was coming into our apartment building, and as she was reaching in to make sure the door didn't close, he saw that she was putting her arm in, and he pushed the door on her arm to stop her from coming in. Couldn't believe it. One day I happened to babysit these two kids, put them down to bed, watching TV, and all of a sudden I hear the loudest sound I had ever heard. I walk into their bedroom. They have pushed over their entire dresser onto the floor. I mean, these kids were just absolutely terrible. This one day, I'm outside in the back of our apartments, the place where we always played. We would play hockey, we would play soccer, we'd play marbles, all kinds of things. And so some of my buddies are out there, and we're playing some kind of sport that day. These two kids are let out from their prison upstairs, third floor. And the one kid comes over and he starts to annoy me. You guys know, right? Like, there are times that kids, that's just like their mission in life, to annoy people. That's just part of who they are. They may not even have it, that may not even be their drive or their purpose. It just may be who they are, because sometimes kids can be annoying. I mean, we love kids, but sometimes kids can be annoying. I'm sure adults can be annoying sometimes too. And this kid's there and he starts to do some things that are annoying. And then he starts to say some things to me, and then he starts to push it. And I can't even remember what he did to push it, but he crossed the line, and I asked him to stop, but he wouldn't do so. I asked him to stop again. He wouldn't do so. The next thing I know, this kid was spitting at me, spitting at in my face. And so I didn't know what it was going to take to stop this kid from doing what he was doing. And friends, I'm not proud of this, but I'm just telling you the story. 12 years old. I picked this kid up, grabbed him by his shirt, and there was a prickly bush in the garden right here. And I walked this kid backwards into the bush until those prickly bushes were pushing into his shirt. And I pushed him into that bush like this in the air. And he said, "Stop, stop, stop." And I said, "Are you going to stop?" "Yes, I'm going to stop." And then I finally put him down. And he stopped. And I won the victory. You're clapping for a very bad action in my life. But friends, I want to tell you that I didn't know what it was going to take to stop him, and there's no doubt I crossed the line in dealing with this kid who was just a few years younger than me. What's it going to take to get you to stop? It's going to take to get you to stop. I've realized that in life we all have a stop threshold, that we will begin to do something, whether good or bad, and we will go a certain distance with that something until we hit our stop threshold, the quitting threshold. There will be certain factors that will cause us to stop. You know, I have three children. They're not quite children anymore. But when they were young, all three of my kids required certain elements to get them to stop their bad behavior. My oldest, Bailey, is our most stubborn child. He's not here this morning, so I can say it. He is the most stubborn child. And when we needed him to stop an action, it required multiple times of us telling him to stop. It required slapping his hand sometimes. It required time out. I mean, it required multiple levels of discipline to finally get him to stop. That was Bailey. Brock, who's here this morning. All it took for Brock was for me to raise my voice. If he knew that I was angry, he would stop. He would pull back. It was much, much easier with Brock. Briar's the easiest. She's not here this morning. She had some teeth pulled out of her face this week for some getting ready for some braces, and she got her wisdom teeth out, so she's watching online. So hi, Briar. And Briar is my easiest of the three, because when Briar did something and we wanted her to stop, all I had to do was give her the look. If I just gave her a look of anger, her face would crinkle up, and she would break into tears. I mean, she would stop the behavior. All I had to do was give her the look. You didn't have to say anything. Just, I'm sorry. Whatever. That's all it took. One, multiple levels of discipline. One, loud voice. One, angry look. Different levels of stop threshold. Each of us has a stop threshold. And so the enemy is going to come at us in different ways, friends. He's going to know what your stop threshold is. He's going to know the very thing that will cause you to stop, that will cause you to quit, and he will attack in various ways. And we're going to see this morning through the book of Nehemiah that the enemy comes after Nehemiah and he attacks on multiple levels because he's not quite sure what Nehemiah's stop threshold is. And before we go to the passage, I just want to say this. Whenever you go after the things of God, the enemy is going to start to attack. We talked about it a little bit last week. But the enemy will attack you because his goal is to stop you from doing what God's got for your life. His goal is to put you into neutral, to get you out of motion, sitting down, quiet, ineffective for the kingdom. His goal is to stop you, and so he will attack you. I want you to open your Bibles to Nehemiah chapter 6. We're going to look at verses 1 to 4, and then 9 to 13. And if you don't have your Bible, you can just look up at the screen. It says, when the word came to Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem, the Arab, and the rest of our enemies, that I had rebuilt the wall and not a gap was left in it, though up to that time I had not set the doors and the gates. So just think about this. He's almost completed. It says, Sanballat and Geshem sent me this message. Come, let us meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono. But they were scheming to harm me. So I sent a messenger to them with this reply. I'm carrying on a great project and cannot go down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and go down to you? Four times they sent the same message, and each time I gave them the same answer. They were all trying to frighten us, thinking their hands will get too weak for the work and it will not be completed. But I prayed, now strengthen my hands. One day I went to the house of Shemaiah, son of Deliah, the son of Mehetabel, who was shut in at his home. And he said, let us meet in the house of God inside the temple, and let us close the temple doors, because men are coming to kill you by night. They are coming to kill you. But I said, should a man like me run away? Should a man like me run away? Or should someone like me go into the temple to save his life? I will not go. I realized that God had not sent him, but that he had prophesied against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. He had been hired to intimidate me so that I would commit a sin by doing this, and then they would give me a bad name to discredit me. Chapter 4 begins the attack upon Nehemiah and the builders of the walls. We start to see it, especially the level of doubt. And then in chapter 5, which we'll look at next week, there's a little bit of internal conflict. In chapter 6, we see the progression of the attack of the enemy, the progression. And this enemy, Sanballat, who's the governor of Samaria, who pretty much is the main man in charge in this region, he is doing everything he can to make sure that the walls don't get rebuilt. And we see in this story that at this point in the timeline that the walls are pretty much done. There just needs to be put some gates in place. And that's a pretty important part, because you don't want to have walls with just open doors so that people can just walk in and kill your family. And so they're partway there. They've gone so far, but the enemy sees that they are so close to the finish line, and he says it's time to attack. And let me just say this to you. I'm going to tell you that the enemy is not just going to attack you at the beginning of your journey. He's not going to just attack you at the end of the journey, but I believe that the enemy will come in with the fiercest attacks when you're close to being finished, when you are close to being done what God has for your life. When you're at that place where the gates are about to be put into place, you're just about there, the enemy will put an all-out onslaught attack on your life, because he doesn't want you to fulfill the will of God. He doesn't want you to fulfill the dreams that God has for you. And so the enemy will provide three attacks that we see in this passage. The very first attack is distraction. Distraction. He says to Nehemiah, come, let's meet in one of the villages. Come on, let's meet in Ono. We're going to meet in Ono. Sanballat up to this point has been discouraging. He has been negative. He's been spreading word. I mean, he's been doing everything he can to stop this work. And Nehemiah, as the leader, has felt this. He's felt the pressure of Sanballat. And there's this moment in this passage where it seems like Sanballat almost gets soft. He's like, hey, you know, maybe I've been a little too hard on you, Nehemiah. Maybe I've been a little wrong in these years. Why don't we meet together? Why don't we meet in a neutral place? Why don't we meet in Ono? Meet in Ono. It seems like a real fair request. But I want you to picture this. Here's Nehemiah, and he's helping rebuild the walls, and he's looking, he's like, this is looking good. We just need to get the gates in place. Everything's fine. And then the word comes, and he starts to think, you know, I've been under attack for quite some time. I've had Sanballat going after me. I've had Tobiah coming after me. I mean, it's just been terrible. And now they want to meet. I'm the leader. Part of my job as the leader is conflict management. So I got to figure out a way to deal with these guys and their offering. And the right thing, the godly thing, would be for me to actually respond to them. You know, I could meet them in Ono. I think this would be good. As the leader, if I could just meet them in Ono and just kind of talk to them. Maybe they just need to know my heart. Maybe I just need to understand where they're coming from. Maybe we could just have a little bit of a negotiation. You know, I think I'm going to go towards this mediation, and I'm just going to just see what they want. And I can just imagine starting to walk away, and he leaves, and all of a sudden hits him. And this is it. This is so important. Because I want you to see my position right now. The moment that he goes towards Sanballat and Tobiah, he's no longer doing the work that God's asked him to do. He's no longer at the place that God's asked him to be. He's right here and he wants to negotiate. It seems so simple. It seems so innocent. But friends, this is what the enemy does. He will try to get you to a place other than what God's asked you to do. He will try to get you to some other place that God's not asked you to be. If I leave the wall and go, and I follow this distraction, then I will be pulled away from the things that God has for my life. I want to tell you that the enemy will always try to distract you. I love this quote. Just look up at the screens by Winston Churchill. He says this, "You will never reach your destination if you stop and throw stones at every dog that barks." You're just going along and you hear the Sanballat barking. And you stop and you deal with them. Another distraction comes and you're trying to get to your journey, but you keep addressing every distraction that comes. If I leave the wall to go after this distraction, I'm no longer doing the work of God. I'll never forget grade 9 history. I don't remember very much about it, but I do remember being in it. Being in grade 9 history, my teacher, his name was Mr. Stewart. He had been a politician, ran for the NDP. I don't remember how well he did. I don't think he did very well, and that's why he was teaching our class. Mr. Stewart was a charismatic individual, being a politician, tall man with a good personality, a little bit of a sense of humor. I'm not sure he had much experience teaching, and so we came into grade 9 history, and some of my buddies thought, why don't we press him? So he starts teaching, and I had this one buddy named Hayes Myers. He would say the little statements, little interjections. And he noticed right at the beginning of this year, this semester, that Mr. Stewart, every time he heard an interjection, would stop his course, and it would be a squirrel moment. You know what a squirrel moment is, right? You know, a dog's going along doing what it's supposed to do, and all of a sudden it's a squirrel, and it just turns its head, right? That was Mr. Stewart. And Mr. Stewart would be teaching, and all of a sudden Hayes would say, "What do you think about the Porsche?" Like, I mean, it had nothing to do with the class. But he said, what do you think is better, a Porsche or a Lamborghini? And Mr. Stewart would go, "Hayes, we'll talk about it later on. I think a Porsche is." And Mr. Stewart would go, no, a Porsche isn't the best. A Lamborghini is way better. And then Hayes would engage him in a conversation for the next 15 minutes. And we were amazed. Hayes Meyer could have had the ability to get Mr. Stewart from this lesson plan way over here. And friends, I got to tell you, for the first 3 months of history, 3-4 months of history, it was the most enjoyable class I went to. Because we didn't learn anything. It was awesome. The goal was to get in class and to see how long it took Hazemeyer or Andy Bernhardt to say something that would get Mr. Stewart distracted. And we would come into the class, and there were times we didn't even open up our notebooks because we just knew there was nothing going to be taught that class. We came into the class, and Mr. Stewart's teaching, and all of a sudden Hayes would say something, and Mr. Stewart would get angry, and Hayes would kick back, and then there's this conversation. The rest of us would check out for the next 15 minutes, or we'd sit there and we'd laugh, and this just kept happening through the whole class. Week after week after week, they would practice this distraction method in class to make the class more enjoyable, and we enjoyed it until 2 weeks before the exam. 2 weeks before the exam, we realized through Mr. Stewart that the exam that would be given had been written by all the history teachers in the school. And while Mr. Stewart taught our class, there was another teacher who taught this group of grade nines, there was another teacher who taught this group of grade nines, and all these other teachers had not been distracted, had dispensed the information their class needed, and there was a standard exam that would need to be taken. And when I went through my notebook and saw the 3 pages of notes I had for a whole semester, the stress levels were through the roof. It was unbelievable. And we started to prepare, and I started to look over things and started to read my textbook. And I'll never forget going into that exam. I've never felt anything like it. I didn't do bad at exams, but this exam, I didn't know anything. I'm going through pages. I'm making stuff up, just hoping Mr. Stewart, I can distract him in my answers. I mean, it's just a mess, and I'm going through it. And I remember I barely passed that exam. It was the worst mark I'd ever gotten in school. I was unprepared for the goal, the task. I was not ready for what I was actually in the class for, the exam. And when we came back after that semester, and we got into class, and Mr. Stewart started to teach, and Hayes Myers said, "Hey, what do you think about the Porsche?" Everybody turned and said, "Why don't you shut up? Don't distract them." Because we knew we could never achieve our goal of getting a good mark in the class if someone kept distracting him. Friends, I can't emphasize it enough. The enemy will always be Hayes Myers. He will always come in and try to get you off the wall, get you off your dream, get you off the thing that God told you to go after. He will always try to distract you with something, something that may not be important or something that may be vitally important, but you exchange God's dream for the thing that the enemy is trying to distract you with. He will always, always distract you. Distractions prevent us from our goal. What does Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 and 2 say? Just look at the screen. "Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses," listen to this, friends, "let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. And let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God." Look at that first part. Let us throw off everything that hinders us. Every time the enemy throws a distraction away, just toss it off. Every time he comes to you and says, "Hey, you need to be more focused on this," just toss it off. I mean, we need to toss off the distractions that the enemy's throwing our way, because we need to be pressing on to the things that God's got for our lives. Let me just speak really personally to you and to me. I find in my life that it is easy to get so distracted by things that just don't matter in light of eternity. I don't know about you, but it's easy to be distracted by entertainment. It's easy to be distracted by the needs of life, the chores and the tasks and the work that's around us. It's easy to be focused on so many things that come our way, to get distracted by those things, that sometimes the very things that God wants me to do, I put little time into it because I'm so distracted by everything else. I'm telling you, the enemy wants to get you away from the wall, have a little meeting, distract you from the things that God's got for you. It's his first attack. The second thing that he will try to do is he will try to discourage you. The Bible says that the enemy was trying to frighten them. And then this phrase is used. It says, "My hands will get too weak for the work, and it will not be completed." My hands, the enemy was trying to make them afraid so that my hands would get too weak for the work, and then things would not be completed. Listen to this. The enemy will put in your life external pressures to create an inner weakness, an inner discouragement. Friends, I want to tell you that some of the things you're facing in life are attacks of the enemy. He is trying to discourage you by pressing you, by putting pressure on you, by creating fear in your life. And we'll talk about fear in a few moments. But by doing things on the outside so that your inside feels like chaos. So that the courage that the Spirit's supposed to place inside of us, so that courage gets dispensed. And all we're left with is this discouragement. And we start to hear His voice. He says, do you really think you should keep going on? Do you really have the energy for this? Do you really have the strength for this? Come on, is it really worth it? Do you really think that's what God wants? And you'll start to feel the pressure, and inside you'll start to feel discouraged. And if He can get us to be discouraged, He can get us to stop what God has for us. When I was 5 years old, we lived in Brampton, Ontario. We lived in this little house beside of a junior high school, and our house was surrounded by a metal fence for the most part, but just the part that was near our carport, there was a brown wooden fence with a gate. And one day I had heard my dad talk to my mom about the need for this gate to be painted. Somewhere in this season, I had watched Huckleberry Finn. Sorry, I just had to remember the name. Huckleberry Finn. You remember that scene where Huck convinces everybody to paint the fence? Anybody remember that? Come on, some of you, you're just waving me. All right, I got three people who remember. Well, it happened. All right, so in this moment, I was enamored by painting fences, and I thought, I need to contribute around here. I'm 5 years old. Like this is important that I would contribute. And so I said to my dad, I said, Dad, I think I can paint the fence. He said, really? Yeah, Dad, I'm pretty sure I can paint. I want to contribute. I think it's time that I be the man around the house. I'm 5 years old. And if you could just allow me to paint the fence, I'll do the best job possible. So my dad said, okay, this Saturday you're going to paint the fence. I was so excited. My mom had talked to me about wearing like my old clothes. When you're a kid, you don't know what old clothes are. You're just rifling through, and it's the ones that your mom most likes but you least like, right? And so I found those and put on some clothes and my little Toronto Blue Jays hat. And my dad took me out, and there was this can of brown paint. And he said, okay, Jeff, I'm going to show you. And so he shows me. He says, you dip the brush into the can, and he starts to show me, and you start doing this. And so he does one length of the board. It's like, all right, Dad, I can do it. So I showed him, did this. Look at me, Dad. Look at my wrist. It's a painter's wrist. It's incredible. I'm so good at this. So I paint the board, and he's like, Jeff, I think you're going to do a great job. So I'm like, friends, I'm so excited. I mean, I know it doesn't excite you to paint a fence brown. For me, 5 years old, I feel like I'm taking on the world. And so my dad goes inside, and I start to paint the fence. And so I'm super happy. I'm not singing or whistling, but inside I'm just full of joy. I start painting the board. And I realize that the board is absorbing this paint faster than I know than I appreciate. And so it takes me a little bit longer, so I got to paint the board a little bit more. And then a little bit more. And I'm working like what seemed like most of my life. And finally, I step back after this long period of training, and I look, and I have barely done anything on the fence. And I am overwhelmed with how long it's going to take to paint this thing. I begin to wonder, what have I got myself into? I put my paintbrush in, so I start painting a little bit faster. Step back. So much. Put it in again, and I'll never forget, because the results, I'll tell you about the results of sex. I'm like this. I'm just like doing things really, really quickly. I don't care what it looks. I just got to make sure it's covered. I mean, if I had not known that this was a bad thing, I probably would have just thrown the bucket at the fence and just done like this or something like that. But I was painting so fast that the paint was spraying all over me. It was all over my Jay's hat. I remember that so clearly because I wrecked that hat. I mean, I look like I like was hit with a disease of freckles. I mean, it was all over my face. And I had worked what seemed like hours, and I was exhausted. And I stepped back, and all I had finished was the gate. Just the gate. And I realized I had this whole fence over here, and this whole fence over here. And I stood there, a little five-year-old, freckled face, not naturally, paintbrush like this, overwhelmed by the task. And discouragement came. I saw the enormity of the task. And so I left the backyard and, you know, five-year-olds, made my way into the house. Dad! My dad came from upstairs. What's up, Jeff? And he looked at me. He could see it was all over me. Dad, I'm so tired. I've been painting for hours. It was probably like 15 minutes, right? I've been painting for hours. Dad, I can't do it anymore. You know how dramatic kids can be, right? I'm going to die. Dad, I can't do it anymore. So my dad goes, well, come on out. Let's see what you've got done. So he comes out and he looks at the gate and he's like, Jeff, that's a really good job. I know, Dad, but it took forever. Dad, I can't do it anymore. Can I be done? My dad said to me, yeah, Jeff, you know, you did a really good job. I'm really proud of you. You can be done. Oh, thank you, Dad. And I make my way inside like I've just been doing a whole hard day's labor, right? Five-year-old dramatic element. That's what happens with us. We begin with energy. We begin to rebuild the wall, go after the dream. We're full of energy. And somewhere in the middle of it, the enemy reminds us of something. You know what he reminds us? It's work. The dreams of God are work. I want to tell you something. You want to partner up with the things that God's got for this church and for your life? Friends, it's not like a roller coaster ride, although that might scare some of you. I mean, it's not a resort. Hey, just join God's dreams and you can go to this resort and just have a great time. I mean, that's not what it is. It is work. And you will find yourself somewhere in the middle of the journey and you're starting to paint God's dream. And the enemy goes, aren't you getting tired? Yeah, my hand's getting a little sore. Look at the task. Wow, there's a whole lot of fence in this dream. I just thought we were painting this. But the pastor says, we got to paint all this. I thought God just wanted one or two boards. But he wants, there's a lot of boards, God. God, there's a lot of, and the enemy will come in and he will start to discourage us with the task. He will start to put things, this pressure in at us and make us feel overwhelmed with what God has called us to do. So much so that our hands will feel weak. They'll feel so weak and tell us that you can't finish it. There's a thing in the Navy called Hell Week. I'm not sure you've ever heard of it. But in the third week of this training to identify the most elite, they will run the potential SEALs through what is called Hell Week. And I'm going to just talk to you a little bit about that. Over the 5.5 days of Hell Week, the potential SEALs will go through rigorous training. They will get about 4 hours sleep every night. They will be put into the coldest conditions, the wettest conditions, the hardest conditions. They will eat very little, have very little sleep. And the idea is that they need to overcome their mind if they're going to overcome their body. Their mind has to be strong because their body will be many times weak. And so the idea is that they would train these SEALs to go through all the hardest pressures externally, but keep things, the inner part, strong. And they will make them be constantly in motion. Every day they'll be walking, they'll be running, they'll be swimming, they'll be carrying boats, they'll be climbing hills. They will be constantly in motion. Did a little reading about this and said that these men are so tired that sometimes even in the middle of an exercise, they'll fall asleep. Can you imagine? I mean, I know some of you fall asleep while I'm preaching, but that's a whole different thing, right? I mean, you're just running. You're running the course, and all of a sudden you're... Can you imagine? Don't drive your car and fall asleep. I mean, you're just doing an exercise, and they're so tired. And the entire time, they're just trying to push themselves, and what research shows is that only 25% of these people will actually complete the Hell Week and become a Navy SEAL. Throughout the entire week, there will be these people in charge, the commanders or Tim, I don't know what the name of it is, or Pete, I don't know if you're here, I don't know what the name of the official commanders are, but there will be these people with these megaphones, and they'll start yelling out, and they'll say, hey, quit. Hey, why don't you quit? Why don't you quit right now? Come on, quit. And all they have to do is there's this pole with a bell, and I wish that I had a string with a bell in it, but we're just going to use a drumstick and a cowbell, okay? Because in church, you can never get enough cowbell. All right. And what happens is all they have to do is in the middle of an exercise, in the middle of a pressure, they just got to come over this pole, and the enemy, the enemy who happens to be their sergeant or their commander will be with the megaphone going, come on, quit, come on, quit, come on, you know that once you quit, you can go sit and eat food, get some sleep, have some comfort, come on, quit. And all they have to do is come over to the bell and start to and walk away with their head down. That's all they have to do. The entire week, every day, going through rigorous external pressure to see if they can defeat the inner person. And all they have to do is pick up the stick or go over and pull the string and ring the bell. And all they have to do is quit, and everything gets comfortable. Please listen to me. Some of you are under some significant pressure, and you feel the enemy's voice. You hear the enemy's voice through his megaphone. And he is reminding you of every external pressure that's coming on your life. Some of you are feeling it physically, health-wise. Some of you are feeling it emotionally. Some of you are feeling it financially, relationally. You are being pressed on every single side. And he is trying to make your hands weak. And you can hear his voice as he's yelling, just pick up the stick. Come on, just pick up the stick. Just come over. Just ring the bell. Just ring the bell. It's all you have to do is quit. All you have to do is ring the bell. Just let go of the dream. Just let go of the vision. All you have to do is ring the bell, and you can quit, and everything will be fine. I'll ease off the attack. I'll ease off the pressure. I'll stop the things that I've been pushing at you. All you got to do is ring the bell. But friends, let me tell you something. If you ring the bell, the pressure may ease up, but the wall will never get completed. God will never get the glory. The things that God has for your life will never be fulfilled. And so when the enemy's coming saying, ring the bell, it's time to quit. Your hands are getting weak. There's no way you can keep doing it. You just let go of the stick and say, I'm going to keep focused on what Jesus has for me. I'm going to keep going. I don't care what you throw at me, enemy. I don't care what comes my way. I'm keeping going. I'm going to keep going because there's a dream to be fulfilled. There's a plan of God that needs to be purposed. I'm going to keep going. Keep going, keep going, keep going, keep going, keep going. What does he say? When he's feeling it and the enemy is trying to make his hands weak, he says this. He says, strengthen my hands, God. I can feel the enemy telling me to ring the bell. I can feel the enemy. It's the same enemy that came after Elijah. He's just defeated the prophets of Baal. He's just won the great victory on Mount Carmel. And then Jezebel says that she's going to kill him. And you know what he does? He runs, hides underneath the tree, and he says to God, I give up. I ring the bell, God. I can't do this anymore. My hands are too weak. But not Nehemiah. He says, God, I feel so weak. I feel so discouraged inside. I feel like quitting. I feel like ringing the bell. But what I'm asking is that you would give me the strength. Strengthen my hands, God. Help me not to quit. God, I'm asking for something supernatural, for power. And friends, listen to me. You need to do the same thing when the enemy's pressing you on every side, discouraging you. When you want to ring the bell, you want to quit. You need to not go talk to a friend or get on Facebook and post about your woes. You need to go on your knees and say, God, would you strengthen my hands? Would you strengthen my hands? I need the power to keep going, God. I need the energy to keep going. The enemy's coming hard at me, but I want the walls built. I want the gates put in place. I want to finish what you've called me to. I want to be just like Jesus, who pressed through to the very end. Strengthen my hands. The enemy will attack you by discouraging you. And lastly, the enemy will attack you with fear. For some reason, Nehemiah goes to a prophet named Shemaiah. And Shemaiah says to him, hey, Nehemiah, listen, you got to go to the house of God. You got to go to the temple. Because the enemy's coming and he's going to kill you. I mean, if there's anything that gets you scared, it's that you're going to die. I mean, friends, everybody, our great fear is, what if I die? What if I get ruined? And he is overwhelmed with fear at this moment. I'm going to be killed at nighttime. At first, the fear, because this is what the enemy's trying to do. He's trying to overwhelm him with fear. At first, the fear is there. And then he says this. He says, this can't be from God. This can't be from God. Because, first of all, I'm not anybody holy. I'm not a Levite. I don't have permission to go into the temple. Why would God ever tell me something that I'm not supposed to do? Number two, why would God ever tell me something that's contrary to the plans he has for my life? This can't be from God. But the enemy tries through fear. The enemy will always try this through fear. He will try to get you to do something that you shouldn't do, or get you to do something that's different than what God has for your life. That's what fear will do. That's what it will do. The enemy will come in and fill you with fear. I read a story this week about a spy who had been caught in Persia. And the general had captured him and had brought him before his presence. And he said, listen, you have two options. He said, we will either put you before the firing squad, or we will put you through a black door. There was this one black door that everybody had been talking about. Black, nobody knew what was on their side. Nobody knew the consequences of the other side. And so he was given the night to think about it. And so the next day, this spy stood before the general, and he said, stood there, and the general said to him, he said, what do you choose? Do you want the firing squad, or do you want the black door? And the man thought about it for a few moments, looked at the black door, so concerned about what was on the other side, so afraid of what could be there. He said, I'll take the firing range. So they put him against the wall, and that day the gunshots were heard. A few moments later, the general turned to his aide, and he said, you know, the truth is that every single person who's given this option always chooses the known over the unknown. Always chooses the known over the unknown. And his aide looked at him and says, well, what's on the other side of the black door? And the general looked at him and said, that's the crazy thing. His freedom. His freedom's on the other side of the black door. But I've yet to meet an individual who's brave enough to open the unknown. And friends, I want to tell you that the enemy will do this. He will cause you to choose the known because you're so afraid of the unknown. Because you are so concerned about the what ifs. What if I don't go to the temple? What if I don't hide? Will the enemy really kill me? What if I really do pursue this thing of God? What if I become ruined financially? What if we can't afford it? What if we don't have the volunteers? What if my reputation's ruined? What if? And the unknown overwhelms us with fear. And so you know what we do? The fear of the unknown causes us to choose the known. And the known isn't what God wants for our life. It's the unknown. It's grabbing his hand and stepping into places like Abraham did, going to a country that wasn't his own. It's just being obedient, saying, God, I don't know what this path looks like, but I trust you, the unknown. We choose the known over the unknown too often. You see, when we give in to fear, we will retreat to a place where we can no longer see God's plan. Let me just walk you through this just for a moment. He's trying to get him to be afraid to go to the known. He knows about the house of God. He knows it's a safe place. He wants him to be afraid of the unknown, of the potential for these people to kill him. And if Nehemiah gives into his fear, he will leave the wall and he will go over, and cameraman, I know you're not going to be able to see me, so that's fine, but he's going to go into a place that's hidden, so he's safe, and he's going to be back here, and he's totally safe. The enemy can't see him, you can't see me, but the thing about it is, if I go to the place that will keep me safe, I can no longer see what God has put in my heart to do. I can't see it anymore. I go to the house of God. I can't see the wall anymore. And I want to tell you, that's what fear does, is it drives you to a place where you can't see the very thing that God put in your heart to do. Your eyes are only on the fearful things. I'm telling you that God wants to call you to a place where you will constantly see the vision. Keep your eyes off the things the enemy's trying to get you afraid of. Keep your eyes off the what ifs. Get your eyes on the thing you know. This is what God has called me to do. This is it. This is it. I want you to imagine this. We all get to heaven one day. We're all walking through the streets of gold and just kind of walking around. And some of us are surprised by who's there. Some of us are surprised we're there, right? I mean, we just get there and we're seeing people, we're high-fiving and go, this is amazing. So incredible. Man, have you tried the food over at the big table at the end of the road? I mean, it's incredible. It's just amazing. And I'm walking along and I'm seeing people, and all of a sudden I see somebody. And I kind of think, just, I don't know how I know, maybe it's a heavenly element, but I just kind of think I know who this individual is. So I just kind of walk by, and I can just kind of overhear this conversation. There's this one man, and he's looking at this other guy whose back is towards him, and he taps him on the shoulder, and he says, hey, is that you? Is that you, Josh? Is that you? And Josh turns around, and he sees Seth, or who he calls Seth. Is that you, Seth? Josh, and they give each other a big hug, and Sether is one of the spies who went to seek out the promised land, but one of the 10 who didn't go. And there's Joshua who did go, and Seth and Josh kind of talk for a few moments, and Seth says to him, hey Josh, can we sit down and just talk for a few moments? Sure. And so they sit down, and Seth says, hey, I got to ask you a question. Did you get there? Did you get there? What do you mean, Seth? The promised land. Did you get there? Oh, man, Seth, we got there. Oh, Seth, we established the very promise that God had for us. It was incredible. Huh. Josh, tell me a little bit about it. Was it good? Oh, Seth, it was incredible. I mean, the luscious grass you've ever seen. I mean, the plumpest cows giving the nicest milk. The fruit was incredible. The dates were just as sweet as could be. I mean, I can't tell you how beautiful the land was, how great the livestock were, how great the food was. It was absolutely incredible. And so for the next 10 minutes, Josh speaks to Seth about the greatness of the promised land. And you can see that there is excitement in Seth's eyes, but there's also disappointment. And so Seth then says to him, he says, Josh, that sounds amazing. Can I just ask you another question? Sure. Were you afraid? When you actually got to the place where you entered into that which God promised you, were you afraid? Oh, Seth, was I afraid? Let me tell you the plan that God gave us to take the first city. And Josh begins to explain about the trumpets, and he begins to talk about the lanterns and about marching around the walls, and he goes, it was the craziest idea. But Seth, I just knew that God promised us this. And so while I was afraid, I mean, we're marching around. I'm pretending I'm confident, but inside I'm like, we're going to die. This is a stupid plan. I mean, the fear is there. But I just keep doing what God told me about. And we took down the city. And then Seth says, I got one more question for you, Josh. If you were so afraid, because I was afraid when we first went in, and that's why I never got to the promised land. I was afraid. They looked like giants. I was so afraid. He says, I want to ask you something. If you had fear, what caused you to go on? And Joshua said, because I kept my eyes focused on the king. Because I kept my eyes focused on the king. I kept my eyes focused on God. You see, Seth, I just need to tell you something. The potential of his promise was far greater than the what-ifs that were in my heart. The potential of his promise was far greater than the what-ifs within my heart. And I just kept my eyes on the king and on his promises. And I got into the promised land. Friends, everybody faces fears. Every person who goes after what God has for them will face a fear. If you think you're going to go after something big for God and you're not going to be afraid at times, I'm telling you, you are on another planet with your thinking. You will be afraid. But like Joshua, like Nehemiah, you keep your eyes on what you're supposed to keep your eyes on. You keep your eyes on God. You keep your eyes on the dream. You keep your eyes on the promise. You grab hold of that great vision that is greater than the what-ifs in your heart. And you just have this faith in your heart that grabs hold of his hand and says, if you want me to walk on water, I'm freaked out by doing this, but I got my eyes on you. I have my eyes on you, so let's just do this. The enemy will always attack with fear. Pastor Steve, come back. The enemy will attack you with distractions. He will attack you with discouragement. He'll attack you with fear. Everybody in this church knows that I love sports. I was sitting with Wayne Tosh on Friday morning. We got talking about football, and at the end of our conversation, I said, you know what? I don't understand people who don't like sports. I said, I just don't. Like, it's meaningful to me. Sports are great when your team's winning. But when your team loses, it stinks. I mean, it's just brutal. It's just brutal. You know, so yesterday my team, Manchester United, was beating Jesse Harrison's team, Chelsea. I don't know if Jesse's here. I hate it when Chelsea beats Manchester United, not because we lose, but I just don't like Jesse talking to me about it. And we were up 2-1, and there was like only a few minutes left in the game. We were in injury time, and they scored a goal to tie it up. We needed the points. It was awful. I thought about talking to Jesse about it. It was overwhelming. Then last night, the Leafs lost. And I could just think about all you Habs fans and Sens fans meeting me today. It's the worst part, friends. I mean, it's the worst part of sports. That if your team loses, someone's going to come and remind you of it. Some cocky Sens fan's going to get in my face. Some arrogant Habs fan's going to get in my face and remind me of the score. That's what I was dreading today. Above all things, not preaching. Nothing else, just some Habs fan, some Sens fan getting in my face. It's the worst part of losing. Why do I share that? If we lose the dream, the consequences are far beyond somebody hurting your pride. If the wall never got built, that meant that the people of Israel were in danger. If the wall never got built, if they lost the dream, then that meant that the people would be in terror, they would be in fear, they would be in danger, and that God would never be glorified. Friends, let me tell you this. If we don't accomplish the dreams that God's got for us, it's not about our pride. It's not about someone getting in our face and mocking us. It's about people's lives being changed. The cost of losing is way too great for the enemy to get us off track. The cost of losing means lives won't be changed. Students won't come to Christ at the University of Ottawa. More young families may not be impacted. People who are in poverty may not be touched. The cost of losing is so much greater than just the pride element. I refuse to lose on the dreams that God's got for this place. I refuse to lose for the dreams that God's got for my life, because the dreams are so big, they're so powerful, they can change lives, that friends, I don't care what the enemy throws at me, I want to keep my eyes focused and keep going. Strengthen my hands. Let me see the things that you're calling me to. Let my eyes be focused so that no distractions will get me off course. Don't quit. Don't quit on the things that God's got for you. Would you stand? I've asked Pastor Steve to lead us in a song, but this song talks about going through trials. It talks about going through difficulties, but at the end of the stanzas, it says in the chorus, I have decided to follow Jesus. No turning back. No turning back. He's given me a dream, and there may be a storm come my way. There may be a distraction. There may be a fear. There may be a discouragement, but I'm not turning back, because there is a vision that he's placed there, and there's a reason it needs to be done. No turning back. Would you sing it, Pastor Steve?
And Christ is my reward, and all of my devotion. Now there's nothing in this world that will ever satisfy. Through every trial, my soul will sing, no turning back. Christ, my all in all, the joy of my salvation. And this hope will never fail, 'cause heaven is our home. Through every storm, my soul will sing, Jesus is here. To God be the glory. Decided to follow Jesus, no turning back. Come on, sing it out, church.
I have decided.
Come on, with all you have.
Follow Jesus, no turning back, no turning back.
One last time, sing it one last time.
I have decided to follow Jesus, no turning back, no turning back. I have decided to follow Jesus, no turning back, no turning back.
I want you to bow your heads and close your eyes for a quick moment. Do two things. First thing is this. You're in this place, you've never given your life to Jesus, but you know that you need Him now. I'm telling you, you can't do anything to get Him except to say, I'm a sinner, Jesus, and your sacrifice was all that was required for me. So today I'm asking you to forgive me for my sins and be in charge of my life. You've never done that, but you say, Pastor, I want to give my life to Jesus today. Would you just raise your hand? Just raise it really quick. Let me see it. Just wave it at me. Is there anybody in this place? Maybe you didn't raise your hand, but you are feeling something you want to ask a little bit more. I'd encourage you to come to the front in a few moments when I finish praying. Talk to one of our prayer team members. Church, I want you to keep your heads bowed and your eyes closed because I really feel the Spirit on me right now just to share some things. Some of you have quit. Some of you have quit what God's asked you to do. I'm telling you, the enemy's won in your life. You were going after a dream. You were going after something you knew was yours, something that God asked you, and you quit. And the enemy's sitting back and he's laughing because you got taken out by his attacks through discouragement, through fear, through distractions. And you're sitting there and you're going, I wish I hadn't quit. I'm telling you that it's not too late. God's speaking to you right now. I'm going to ask you to slip out of your pew and just come to the front and just find a place alone and say, God, I'm picking up the dream that I quit. Just come on. There's some people here. I just feel it so deep in my heart. Some people who've quit. I really feel there were some who were just so discouraged by some things. You just backed right down from the dream that God had. Come on. Nobody's looking, just you and me. God's speaking to you right now. Say, Pastor, I've been discouraged. I quit. Would you slip out? Find a spot just somewhere by the front. You don't need to go to one of our prayer team members. Thank you. Thank you for those who are coming. Second call is this, and then I'll close. Some of you are under attack. I mean, friends, life throws some curves at us. There's no doubt about that. But when all the pitchers got is curveballs, you know you're under attack. You've been feeling it lately, and you feel like the things that God's put in you are so big, the things that He's stirring you towards are so important, but you just feel the attacks. I'm inviting you to slip out and just come to one of our prayer team members just for a few moments. They're not going to take long, but they want to pray with you. And friends, I know this is going to be for some of you. I'm going to just say it the way it is. This is going to be a pride thing, because some of you know that God's speaking to you, but it's the pride that keeps us back, because you don't want anybody thinking there's something wrong. There's nothing wrong with you. The most godly people are the people who are under attack. The people who are used the most by God are the ones who come under attack. Please, if God is nudging your heart saying, it's you, you've been under attack, would you slip out of your seat right now and just have someone come and pray with you? Some of you are facing some physical attacks. Some of you emotional. Some of you, this is in your family. Some of you, it's financial. Come on, you're just feeling, you feel like you press down every side. There's somebody right now who you can't get to sleep at nighttime because you constantly are living with stress. The enemy keeps speaking to you about the what ifs and you just can't sleep. God's getting your attention right now. You need to slip out because he wants to set you free. He wants you to have a good night's sleep. So whoever that is, would you slip out right now? Come on. Come on, God's speaking to you. There's somebody in this place, you've talked to your spouse about quitting an area of ministry because you face some discouragements and frustrations, and you're wondering whether or not you can keep going. Your hands are feeling weak, but the enemy has been attacking you, and you've talked to your spouse this week and said, I feel like giving up. God's speaking to you right now. He wants to touch you right now. Whoever that's for, just slip out. Come on, slip out. There are some people in this place that God has placed something in your heart. He's placed an idea, a dream. And some of you even hate this series because you know that there are things in your heart, but you refuse to grab hold of it, not because you don't want to or you want to be disobedient, but because there is a great fear in your heart about the potential of harm, the potential of disaster, the potential of failure. The fear is pushing you away from your dream. And God is speaking to you right now. You feel that nudge right now. You actually want me to shut up right now because you feel it so much inside. If that's you, the Spirit's trying to get a hold of your life. He wants to set you free from that fear. If that's you, would you just step out from your seat right now? Come on, he's speaking to you. He's speaking to you right now. Churches, we're about to close. You can sit in your seat. You can kneel wherever you want. But I'm telling you this. I'm not trying to be negative, but I'm telling you. As we as a church go after what God's got for us, the enemy will attack. As you as a church member go after what God's got for you, the enemy will attack. He will discourage. He will distract. He will cause fear to come your way. He will make doubt rule your mind. But I'm telling you that if you will grab hold of God, if you will stay focused, if you will ask him to strengthen you, if you will keep your eyes focused on the dream, the enemy will not win. That God's dreams will be accomplished. And so, Father, as we conclude this service, I'm asking that nobody would ring out. I'm asking that nobody in this place would ring the bell. But God, that we would go after the things that you've got for us. Those who are discouraged, fill them with encouragement. Strengthen their hands. Those who are distracted, keep their eyes focused on you. Those who are afraid, I pray that you would speak loud, that you are with them. The Spirit of God is with them. Not by might, not by power, but by his Spirit, says the Lord. God, I pray we would go after our dreams, and when the enemy attacks, we would stand resilient. Let this church be your hands. Let this church fulfill your dreams. Let this church make an impact this week, I pray, so that God, your kingdom will advance. Bless each person now as they leave this place. In Jesus' name, amen. Bless you, everyone.